This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Egal, ob Sie gerade erst beginnen oder Ihr Sicherheitsprogramm erweitern, herausragende Sicherheitspraktiken zu demonstrieren und Vertrauen aufzubauen, ist wichtiger denn je. Vanta automatisiert die Einhaltung von ISO 27001, SOC 2 und mehr, spart Ihnen Zeit und Geld und hilft Ihnen, das Vertrauen Ihrer Kunden zu stärken. Darüber hinaus können Sie Sicherheitsüberprüfungen vereinfachen, indem Sie Fragebögen automatisieren und die Sicherheit Ihrer IT-Infrastruktur mit einem kundenorientierten Trust Center demonstrieren. Über 9000 globale Unternehmen wie Atlassian, FloHealth und Koora nutzen Vanta bereits, um Risiken zu managen und Sicherheit in Echtzeit nachzuweisen. Erhalten Sie ein spezielles Angebot von $1000 Rabatt unter vanta.com/horen.
Hello, I'm James Kamarasamy. Thank you for downloading the BBC's World Tonight podcast for Tuesday, the 4th of March. President Zelensky has said Ukraine is ready to work fast to secure a peace deal with Russia and heaped praise on Donald Trump after the United States paused military aid shipments to Ukraine. We get reaction from a Ukrainian MP and a Republican congressman in the United States. And we'll look at the calls for Europe to use hundreds of billions of dollars in frozen Russian assets to support Ukraine. We remember the man with the golden arm, the blood donor credited with saving more than 2 million lives. Hear about the children from Gaza getting life-saving treatment in Jordan. And as a supermarket chain adds it to its lunchtime meal deals, when is it acceptable to drink alcohol-free beer? When Donald Trump addresses both houses of the US Congress in the next few hours, he may be able to unveil what he would characterize as a win. It is being reported, he's told advisers, he wants to announce the delayed Ukraine minerals deal tonight. Delayed after that disastrous encounter in the Oval Office on Friday, which ended with President Zelensky heading home empty-handed and, as of today, without US military aid entering his country. Donald Trump's overnight decision to suspend all US military shipments to Kiev appears to have focused the Ukrainian leader's mind. This afternoon, Mr. Zelensky used a post on X to say he was ready to sign the minerals deal and to come to peace talks. He also praised Donald Trump for his strong leadership and expressed his gratitude both to him and the American people for their support throughout the war. It was a message he emphasized during his nightly address to the nation.
Ukraine will always be grateful to America for all the support that has been provided and continues to be provided. Support that is now essential to preserving Europe's already fragile security foundations. This is not just about our country. It's about all of Europe. We seek constructive cooperation, true partnership.
And to that end, Mr. Zelensky also expressed regret for the way that Friday's Oval Office meeting had gone.
What happened at the White House instead of our negotiations is regrettable. But we must find the strength to move forward, to respect each other, just as we have always respected America, Europe, and all our partners. And together, we must do everything to bring peace closer.
His comments came on what was for many Ukrainians a day of sorrow and disbelief following that decision to pause US military aid to their country and after what appears to be a concerted arm-twisting effort from European leaders, including Keir Starmer, who spoke to Mr. Zelensky shortly before he posted his words of contrition. Lesya Vasilenko is a Ukrainian MP from the opposition Holos party. Does she think President Zelensky has done the right thing?
The US is still a major contributor to Ukraine's defense and security and to Ukraine's livelihood in our fight against Russia's aggression. So the way that the situation turned out last week at the Oval Office definitely caused a stir of emotions in Ukraine, but also a wave of concerns. So the way that President Zelensky reacted today by putting out a public internationally visible message saying that he is ready to return to the talks and he is in fact grateful, as all the Ukrainian people are grateful for the US support. It's a dignified position and it's a responsible position of a leader of a country that wants to survive.
And it came after President Trump had announced that military aid to Ukraine was being suspended. Did he have any choice?
Did he have any choice? Well, was US aid, especially in the defense and security sector, Ukraine definitely has a better chance of survival and of standing up and coming out of this with a peace deal that will A, be long term, and B, be accepted by the Ukrainian people as just.
And we're hearing from the United States that President Trump wants at least to announce that he has done, signed the deal on Ukrainian minerals as part of a future peace agreement tonight. Is that a good thing for Ukraine?
Well, we were open to having this deal done. In any case, this is the deal with which President Zelensky went to the Oval Office in the first place. We are happy to build on partnerships, on our natural resources and on the rare earth metals. We are happy to open our borders for international companies to come and explore them and see what is there. So, of course, this deal would be beneficial in terms of economics, but also in terms of having American companies on the ground and an American state interest, which presumably the American army would henceforth protect.
And then what? I mean, presumably for a start, you hope that this will unblock the military aid, but where next? Does President Zelensky have to return to the White House and continue to be contrite?
Well, definitely there needs to be a follow-up on the talks and on the dialogue that is happening between President Zelensky and President Trump. I would imagine that from a diplomatic point of view, this dialogue would need to be happening between closed doors, because there's a lot to be discussed, a lot of sensitive information to be discussed that has to do with defense and security and with the strategy on defense and security of Ukraine, not just on the general terms that a peace deal needs to be signed. Yes, a peace deal needs to be signed, but what's in it, the details of it and how it is achievable, that is something for two leaders of two countries to decide among themselves, along with the involvement of military, of intelligence, and of other political chains of command, political and military chains of command.
After what has happened over the past few days, do you think you can still trust the United States?
Well, we don't really have a choice, do we? We have to trust the countries who claim to be democracies, who have stood up for democracies for all their time in history. And there's so much that has been invested both from the American side into Ukraine and from the Ukrainian side into the relationship with the United States that... at least from the Ukrainian side, we are willing to give this relationship a go.
That was the Ukrainian MP Lesya Vasilenko. Well, let's get some reaction to the day's developments from the United States. Speaking to the BBC earlier, Democratic Congressman Steny Hoyer said the Ukrainian leader was forced into sending that message to President Trump, and he pointed to the history between the two men.
I think what Zelensky had to say today was a positive message, although I think it's unfortunate that he had to give that message because he was put in a corner, bullied, if you will, into having to say he's thankful. Obviously, he's thankful. He said that repeatedly. But frankly, we all remember that Trump was impeached because he tried to make a deal with Zelensky for his own political purposes, that Zelensky courageously said, I don't want to be involved in this. And I think the president still holds that against him. And that's sad because this fight is our fight as well as Ukraine's fight. This fight is Europe's fight as well as our fight.
Well, let's get the view from the other side of the aisle from President Trump's Republican Party. We can speak live now to Tim Burchett, Republican congressman from Tennessee, who sits on the Foreign Affairs Committee of the U.S. House of Representatives. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on.
First of all, that point that Steny Hoyer made, a Democrat, he said that the fight is America's fight as well as Ukraine and Europe's fight. Do you believe that?
How is it America's fight? It's Europe. We put $250 billion into this. And Zelensky comes to America and starts making demands of us. That's just not the way it works. He also worked against President Trump in his election. He was out campaigning for Kamala Harris, and he you know, Ukraine's apparently engaged.
You're talking about the visit he made to an arms factory in Pennsylvania in a swing state.
That's correct, in a swing state, which was very, very important. Of course, she got beat there. It didn't do her any good. But also, you have Joe Biden's son with his $80,000 a month consulting job over there, whatever it was. So, you know, this thing's gone on too much. It's about money. It's about greed. It's about people getting rich on both sides of the aisle, on both sides of the ocean.
And there is still obviously money involved, because we're now talking about this rare earth mineral deal, aren't you? Are you pleased that it looks, I don't know if you've heard anything, that it looks as though it's going to be signed perhaps tonight?
Yeah, that sounds like what we understood. But the interesting thing about that rare earth minerals is that they're in a combat zone. So when we start getting the minerals out of there, Russia will not want to harm a hair on an American business person's head. He does not want that, or he would incur the wrath of this country. So I think it's a masterful move by Trump. It'll do well for the Ukrainians. It'll do well for us. We need the rare earth minerals.
Does that mean that you think that American troops or some kind of American security is going to have to be sent there
to deter
the Russians? Or you think that the mere fact that business people are there and businesses from America are there will be enough?
I think Putin understands the game. I don't think he's going to do anything, any shape, form, or fashion to harm an American citizen.
What about the decision today to suspend military aid to Ukraine? What kind of message do you think that sent?
I think it's a great message. Trump ran on it. He's keeping his word. I've never voted for one red cent for Ukraine. It's not our war. It's Europe's war. We have funded this thing from day one. The American taxpayers have, and a lot of times it's not even with our permission, done by executive orders. So I think it's long overdue.
When Europeans hear those kind of statements, they wonder whether America is an ally anymore. Can you understand that?
Yeah, I can understand it, but they're wrong. We're an ally. But again, it's not our war. It's if we were given an equal share of what Europe, it's in Europe, but yet the United States of America is the one that's funding it. And then when you have European leaders talk about bringing in NATO and bringing in American troops, that's American boys and girls. And I don't know that Congress is ready to make that commitment.
You mentioned NATO. I just wonder what kind of message it's sending to NATO more broadly, then, this decision to suspend the aid to Ukraine. What does it say to NATO?
I think it says to NATO that America is not going to be the world's peacekeepers. We're going to have to protect our own. We have done a poor job of protecting our own borders, and we've stretched our fiscal ability very thin with this war, and we've done enough, and it's time for everybody else to step up.
Now, I mean, you're clear that this was President Putin who started the war. You're clear that he...
Putin's a no-good thug. There's no question there. But again, here we are messing in another war, somebody else's business. Where were we when China was imprisoning the members of the Uyghur population and forced organ harvesting, slaughtering those people, putting them in concentration camps? We were nowhere. And the reason we weren't, because we need their... We need their goods. We need their computer chips. I mean, look on the back. If you're wearing a tie, if you're wearing formal wear, look on the back of that tie and look, see where it's made. Made in China. Because we're addicted to their goods.
Just a very final thought then, just to come back to NATO. Article 5, is it still good?
I think it is, but America can't be the total enforcer. And the other nations have not. If you remember, under Trump's previous administration, a lot of the European nations were not paying their dues, and America was, and that needs to stop.
Congressman, appreciate your time. Republican Congressman Tim Burchett there. And coming up later, we'll hear from the grandson of a man whose prolific blood donations over seven decades are thought to have saved the lives of millions of people.
He would find a blood bank, no matter where he was. Nothing would stop him from donating. Love the attention from the nurses. He's a little bit of a flirty bloke with them.
His grandson will tell us more about him. The man they called the man with the golden arm. Now, Apple is to take legal action here in the UK over the government's demand for it to create a backdoor in its cloud storage to give the state access to customers' private data if required. President Trump has criticised the move. He's compared it to Chinese surveillance. It's the latest development in an unprecedented row between one of the world's biggest tech firms and the government. Let's get more. We're joined by James Titcomb, the Telegraph's technology editor. Good evening, James.
Good evening.
So what exactly is Apple doing here?
So what's emerged today is that Apple is appealing an order that Yvette Cooper, the Home Secretary, secretly gave the company back in January, saying it had to break its encrypted iCloud system. What it's doing now is it's appealing to the Investigatory Powers Tribunal, which is the court that regulates MI5 and GCHQ and security services such as that. We don't really know where we go from here because this is very unprecedented territory, but clearly Apple is going to fight this as strongly as it can.
Yeah, I mean, just remind us of the details of what the government's been asking Apple to do.
Yeah, so Apple has in iCloud, which almost every iPhone has to back up messages and photos and contacts and things like that. They recently introduced a couple of years ago an encrypted version of that, which means Apple can't see that, the security services can't see that. You're the only person that can see that if you have an iPhone. That is controversial because it means that security services are not able to access that information from Apple when they're doing criminal investigations. So back in January, Yvette Cooper gave Apple what's called a technical capability notice. It's a secret notice, which means the company can't disclose it, the Home Office can't disclose it. But effectively, it's in order to create a backdoor so that they can access that data. And Apple appears to have simply said no.
And as I mentioned, there is a diplomatic, geopolitical aspect to this as well. The US administration not pleased at all.
No, quite. I mean, this is a really interesting element of this story because Silicon Valley chief executives such as Tim Cook, the boss of Apple, have got very close to Donald Trump and the new administration, and they see the White House as a way of fighting back against a lot of enforcement from overseas governments. So not only has Trump hit out at it, but Tulsi Gabbard, his national intelligence director, has said she's going to investigate whether this is even legal under US-UK data treaties. She's called it an egregious act. And this is not just going to be a UK story. It could be a transatlantic one now.
Any reaction from the government?
The problem with this story is that this process is very secretive. It's sort of subject to gag orders, and even disclosing the existence of the notice is not allowed under these surveillance laws. So, all of they've said is that it's important that we're able to access information about criminals. But really, this is a process that is happening in secret and is only emerging in drips and drabs. So, and probably continue to do so.
Interesting. Well, one to follow. Thanks very much, James Titcomb, the Telegraph's technology editor. Let's return now to Ukraine because the flurry of diplomatic activity continues this week. EU leaders are meeting for a special summit on Ukraine and European security. And the Defence Secretary, John Healey, will be travelling to Washington to discuss the details of a peace deal with his US counterpart, Pete Hegseth. President Zelensky is scheduled to attend Thursday's EU meeting in Brussels, and with the pause in US military aid to Ukraine focusing minds on future financial support for Kiev, calls are growing louder for the EU and UK to use frozen Russian assets to support Ukraine. Today, MPs have been discussing the legal basis for using hundreds of billions of dollars of Russian assets for that purpose. Among those in attendance, someone who's been calling for this for some time, Sir William Browder. You might better know him as Bill Browder, once the biggest foreign investor in Russia. He fell foul of President Putin after exposing corruption and now campaigns for sanctions to be imposed on human rights abusers and corrupt officials. And he joins us on the line. Good evening.
Good evening to you.
So is this the right time then? Has the events of the last few days mean that this is a moment when using these frozen Russian assets is something that is now being considered?
Well, it's been the right time since Putin launched this war of aggression against Ukraine. Ukraine didn't do anything to provoke him. He went in to Ukraine with tanks and guns and bombs and and has caused an enormous amount of damage. And shortly after the war began, the Western allies froze $300 billion of his central bank reserves. And we're now in a situation where he's done probably $1 trillion of damage. And then furthermore, we're now in a situation where Ukraine is desperate for funds to keep on fighting off the Russians because Donald Trump has stopped military aid to Ukraine. And so there couldn't be a more relevant time for us to be using the frozen assets for the defense of Ukraine.
And you're stressing the urgency. You wrote a piece in the Mail, the title, "We Must Not Wait a Minute Longer to Use Russia's Frozen Billions to Aid Ukraine's Fight." Why has there been a wait, in your view?
Well, because it's one of these things where, first of all, we can't do it by ourselves. We need to do it with our European allies and Canada and Japan and other countries. And there was always somebody who was saying, well, it's complicated. It's never been done before, and so on and so forth. But we're in a desperate situation now where if the defensive lines of Ukraine collapse, which they will do if they don't have enough money to buy weapons, then we're going to end up with 20 million Ukrainian refugees fanning out across Europe and the UK. We're going to end up with Putin challenging Estonia, Latvia, or Lithuania. We're going to end up with defense spending at 7% of GDP. It'll be a disaster. And so there's an absolute urgency to doing something and doing something now.
It's coming from some interesting quarters, including the former Prime Minister Rishi Sunak. He is called for this. I mean, the government announced more aid to Ukraine over the weekend, but that is from the interest on assets, isn't it? So that is something that has been done, but the if you like, the full fat version, still it's being held back. But do you think it's changing? Do you think attitudes are changing?
Well, I mean, there's a very simple question for Keir Starmer and for Emmanuel Macron and for the new incoming Chancellor of Germany, which is, who should pay for this? Should the taxpayers of the UK, France, and Germany pay for the amount of money that America used to give that we're going to now have to pony up? Or should Putin pay? And it's pretty simple. I mean, the answer is Putin should pay.
The trouble is, though, isn't it, that he seems to be, judging from the statements from the White House, possibly being welcomed into the fold. Has the moment perhaps not gone if Donald Trump is going to sit down with Vladimir Putin and not just do a deal over Ukraine, but it would seem try and bring him back into the G7, the G8, and have a bigger strategic partnership with him? Has perhaps a time passed when this could be done?
Absolutely not. I mean, we're now gearing up defense spending. We're talking about, you know, all in on Ukraine. Putin hasn't stopped his war. Their bombs are going off right now as we speak, and all over Ukraine. I mean, you know, Donald Trump can do whatever he wants with Putin, but Putin's at war with Ukraine, and he's at war with Europe, and you know, we're not, you know, he's, you know, Vladimir, if Vladimir Putin were to stop his war, if he were to pull out, you know, then there's some, and if he paid reparations to Ukrainians, then there's some idea about bringing him in from the fold into the cold, but not now.
So what are the practical steps to make this happen, if it is going to happen?
It's just a very simple political will. You know, the same way as we were able to organize ourselves very quickly when COVID hit with all sorts of amazing initiatives, the same thing can happen here. It just requires political will. And there hasn't been political will because everybody was sort of sitting back and sort of hoping for the best and thinking it was all going to work out, but it's not working out. Donald Trump has suspended military aid for Ukraine. 40% of all military aid came from the Americans. Without the American money, Ukraine's defensive lines will fall, and we have to fill in the blanks. And if we don't do it from taxpayer money, which we shouldn't, we should do it from Putin's money.
Sir Bill Browder, many, many thanks for joining us. Now in Australia, tributes have been paid to a prolific blood donor who's died at the age of 88. It is thought that the blood plasma donated by James Harrison saved around 2.4 million babies. Mr. Harrison had a rare blood type that contained an antibody known as anti-D. It's given to expectant mothers who have an immune system which attacks the red blood cells of their unborn child. Mr. Harrison donated every fortnight for decades. The Australian Red Cross Blood Service called him the man with the golden arm. Here he is speaking almost a decade ago.
It becomes quite humbling when they say, oh, you've done this or you've done that, or you're a hero. No, I said, it's something I can do. You know? It's one of my talents. Probably my only talent is that I can be a blood donor.
Well, my colleague Rebecca Kesby on the BBC World Service NewsHour programme has been hearing more about this remarkable man from his grandson, Jared Mellowship.
He was just a hard-working, nice bloke. Always looked after us. He just made sure he donated his blood every 2 weeks, and that's it. Loved his travelling, but even when he was travelling, he had to donate his blood.
How did he do that when he was on the road?
He would find a blood bank, no matter where he was. I know every winter he would go to Queensland for 3 months because it's warmer up there, up in the tropic, and he found a blood bank at Maroochydore, and he'd go there every 2 weeks. And he'd time it so that he could always donate no matter where he was.
And, I mean, this does sound as if this was a thing that he took incredibly seriously.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Wouldn't give it up for anything. Well, he just felt like he had to give back to, you know, the cause that kind of saved his life. I think he had a lung removed when he was 14. And in that surgery, he took a whole heap of blood. And that's what they believe, or from what I know, has created this thing he's got in his blood or had in his blood, because he took in a whole heap of different blood types when he had this transfusion. So that was when he was 14. So he swore that when he turned 18, he would start donating blood back. And then as it progressed, they found he had this special stuff, and here we are today.
Really? Okay, so that's fascinating. Yeah. So his plasma contained this rare antibody, didn't it, known as anti-D. And it's very rare. Hardly anybody's got it, which I guess is why he wanted to make sure that he was donating. And I understand he also donated to your mother for your birth. Is that right?
Yeah, Mum had to have the injection so then I could have a brother. So then Scott was born, and then Mum had another injection with Scott in case they had another baby but didn't.
Right. I mean, the Australian Red Cross Blood Service have been paying their tributes to him, saying, you know, how many pints of blood he donated. It's into the thousands, isn't it, over the decades.
Oh, yeah.
He was giving blood, saved over 2 million children. They called him the man with the golden arm.
Yep, that's what he's always been known as.
And since he passed away, lots of people have been paying tributes to him, including many of the people whose lives he effectively saved.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Everyone's kind of not coming out of the woodworks, but how, you know, this injection was able to create their babies and all that kind of stuff. And without that, they, you know, might not have had children and families quite similar to my family. My wife had to have the injection 3 times so that we could have our 4 kids.
Really? Goodness me.
Yeah.
Quite a legacy then.
Yeah, no, it's pretty humbling. No, he was just a man set in his ways. Nothing would stop him from donating. Love the attention from the nurses. He's a little bit of a flirty bloke with them.
Right.
You know, he's a little cheeky, but he was all right. It was all harmless. He's good. Good egg.
You must be very proud of him.
Oh, of course. Of course. But he's just granddad to us.
Just granddad, the granddad with the golden arm. That was Jared Mellowship speaking to the BBC's Rebecca Kesby about his granddad, James Harrison. Arab delegations who met in Cairo have today approved a plan for Gaza's reconstruction. It is designed as an alternative to Donald Trump's proposal for an American takeover of the territory and the displacement of Palestinians. According to the host of the emergency summit, President Sisi of Egypt, the Egyptian proposal involves the creation of a body of independent Palestinian professionals to temporarily oversee Gaza's affairs. Well, whatever the shape of the territory's future, the World Health Organization says that at least 12,000 sick and wounded Palestinians require immediate evacuation from Gaza, and thousands more have life-changing injuries that will require years of rehabilitation. Among them is 9-year-old Rami, who arrived in Jordan last month for treatment at a hospital run by the medical charity Doctors Without Borders. The BBC's Caroline Hawley has been to meet him.
In the physiotherapy room here, there are patients pushing through their pain and discomfort, desperate to try to get something of their former lives back. It's a bright and cheery room, sunlight pouring through the windows, but everyone here has been through really dark times. The youngest of them here now is Rami. He's just 9, and his legs were really badly injured by shrapnel from an Israeli airstrike last summer in Gaza. It killed his older brother.
We were sleeping, and then they bombed our neighbour's house, and we were hit by shrapnel.
He's wearing a white vest, blue shorts, and a look of real determination.
I mean, he came with the severe deformity in both legs. In the beginning, he came with a wheelchair.
Rami is here with his physiotherapist, Zaid. He's put aside his red, blue and green crutches.
He wants to play football.
With you?
Yes.
Wow. Okay.
He supports Cristiano Ronaldo. So he wants to play football like him. This is the first time for me I let him to play football by his leg.
So this is the first time he's kicked a football since his injury.
This is a big moment.
Yes. Also for me, it's a very nice moment actually.
Rami's with the nurse now, having the dressings on his legs changed. He's had one operation since he arrived at MSF's Specialised Hospital for Reconstructive Surgery, which treats victims of war from around the Middle East. It hurts, he says, but it's nothing like the agony he suffered during surgery in Gaza, with no painkillers and no antibiotics. His wounds were so infected they had maggots in them, and doctors said both legs would have to be amputated. Many more rounds of surgery lie ahead.
In Gaza, before the war, we used to have medical treatment, but then the aid stopped.
He lists his surviving brothers and father still in Gaza, and then breaks down, remembering 12-year-old Mustafa, who's no longer there.
I see him in my dreams, laughing and happy. I see him as an angel.
Mustafa's mum, Islam, accompanied Rami to Jordan, hard as it was to leave Gaza and the grave of her oldest child.
My heart is in Gaza. My soul is in Gaza. Despite what happened in Gaza, I love it. I just want to get Rami treated here and then go back there.
Rami's getting more mobile now on his crutches, one of 13 Palestinian children being treated here. But the World Health Organization says thousands of others need to be brought out of Gaza because the health system has collapsed. It estimates that the war has left 30,000 people with life-changing injuries. With such staggering figures, the MSF hospital's director, Roshan Kumarasamy, says it's able to provide just a drop in the ocean of need.
Any point on the unimaginable massive spectrum of injuries you can ever conjure up in your mind, it's all there. In the thousands, people will be doing reconstructive surgery for Gaza patients for years to come, and the surgery that will be needed for the psychological aspect, some will never recover.
Rami's dad in Gaza has his brother Aboud on his lap, tickling him to try to cheer him up. Aboud is 8 years old and one of many, many amputees. He lost his lower right leg and has crutches to walk on, but no prosthetic yet. When the Israeli military allowed Rami and his mum to leave Gaza in January, Aboud and his dad weren't able to go too.
Hi, Rami. Habibi.
They've been keeping in touch as much as they can by phone, and sometimes there's been just enough signal for a blurry video call. Rami tells his family he misses them and wants to show his dad how he can now get up by himself and stand on his own 2 feet. You're strong, his father tells him. You're a hero. And today, another reason for the family to cheer. The Israeli authorities have just allowed Rami's brother and their father to leave Gaza for Jordan so that Aboud can get treatment too.
And that report from Jordan was by the BBC's Caroline Hawley. Now, if I told you that I only managed to get through an edition of The World Tonight by swigging a bottle of beer, what would you think? If I told you it was alcohol-free beer, would that make a difference? Well, the question of when it is appropriate to drink alcohol-free beers has reared its fizzy head after a leading supermarket chain announced it was including Lucky Saint Lager and Corona Zero as part of its lunchtime meal deal. So is there a right and a wrong time and place, or does the growing popularity of zero alcohol versions of beer and indeed other drinks mean it's becoming more acceptable to drink them whenever you want? Nigel Barden's a food and drink broadcaster, and he joins me now. Good evening, Nigel.
Good evening, James. I also am just pouring, here you go, from a great height, one of those low-alcohol beers, which is 0.5. There's more alcohol in a banana or a fruit juice. So to put it in perspective.
Well, we're drinking, you know, I mean, this is acceptable time to have a drink. I mean, perhaps not for me in the studio. But look, the Etiquette Bible de Brett says that a can of low or no alcohol lager with your lunchtime sandwich and crisps could, quote, make you look like someone who really wants a drink. Whether that's a good or a bad thing, I don't know. But, I mean, they don't approve. You do you?
Yeah, I think it's perfectly acceptable. We are drinking more. So it's a huge growth area, and for good reason. People are drinking less alcohol. Younger people are drinking less alcohol. But low alcohol drinks, not just beer, but wine and spirits, stunt doubles, they're all increasing. It's because people want the flavour. They want the hit. But they don't want the alcohol and the effects of it. And I think that's perfectly reasonable. And also, you think about it with a meal deal, but actually, rather than having a sugar-rich, fizzy drink, you're going to have a low-alcohol beer, which has got the taste of hops and everything, so much more grown-up flavour. Then I don't think there's a problem with that.
At the desk as well? At work?
Yeah, well, I would do that. I mean, I don't want to be, you know, breathing beery breath over colleagues. I have to say, I'd be sensitive to that. But I'd be sensitive to whatever I was drinking. If I was drinking Bovril or Marmite, it'd be the same. I'm showing my age there. But also, no, I don't think it is really a problem. I think it's something we should become more used to because it is an increasing area of consumption. But also, I think it means that people are aware that actually you can enjoy beer, but it doesn't have to be alcoholic.
So, anything off limits? Is it? I mean, to coin another alcohol slogan, anytime, any place, anywhere.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, over the years, I mean, people used to drink small beer in Elizabethan Britain, you know, because you couldn't drink the water, and all the family drank it. It was very low alcohol, but it did have alcohol in it. But they reckon it was much safer than drinking the water. So, a lot of it is just perception, and I think that's what we have to get used to. But I mean, if you have people have a Buck's Fizz for breakfast, you know, and I suppose if you're in your weekend away, that's all par for the course. So simply with beers as well, I think this is something we need to get used to because we're going to see it more and more.
Yeah, I mean, let's look at the other side of it. I mean, clearly, this is a result of the popularity of alcohol-free beers. What's this down to? Is it just you think people looking at the health benefits and wanting to enjoy what's there? I mean, is the marketing been great? What is it?
There's definitely that, but there's without doubt, once the really good brewers got involved, the quality of the beer has got so much better than ever before. So you can have a really good hoppy beer that delivers, you know, the bitterness that you want. But it could be, I mean, you just mentioned a couple earlier on, but Adnams is a beer that has a really dark element to it. There are lagers as well out there on the market. There are different, whole different plethora. There are stouts, which are low alcohol. I mean, the black stuff, the from Ireland, you know, that's a huge seller of the zero version of that. So I just think, get used to it, James. We're going to have more of it.
Got it. We'll have to call last orders on you, I'm afraid, Nigel. But thanks so much for joining us. Nigel Barden, food and drink broadcaster there on the appeal of low alcohol beers and other spirits. And that is The World Tonight. This is James Kamara-Sami. I'll be back tomorrow at 10. But for now, from me and everyone on this very sober program, good night.